Hello and welcome to End of Life University Podcast, where we share real talk about life and death. I'm your host, as always, Dr. Karen Wyatt. I'm a retired hospice physician, now an author, speaker, educator around end of life issues, and this podcast comes from my desire to share honest information and discussions about how to prepare for the end of life and how to live life in such a way that we no longer fear death and dread death. So that's my goal for this podcast. Today, I'm sharing with you a solo episode, and I'm going to be talking about death's big tent, making room for every point of view, and I'll get into that in just a minute. But first, I wanted to thank once again all of my donors on my page at patreon.com/EOLU who've been supporting this podcast for the last couple of years. I'm excited because we're now up to 93 donors who are supporting this podcast on a monthly basis by making small contributions of just a few dollars a month. But it's making a huge difference, helping me keep the podcast on the air and defray all of the expenses of the podcast. And I wanted to let you know, because we're getting close to the milestone of 100 supporters, at which time I have pledged, when we reach 100, that I'm going to start doing a monthly update on end-of-life news for all of my Patreon supporters. And also, from time to time, a review of movies and television series that relate to end-of-life issues, which my husband and I are going to do together. That will start happening when we reach 100 donors, and so we just have 7 to go. So if you know someone who might be interested in supporting this podcast with as little as $2 a month, get some people to sign up and get us over that 100 donor milestone, and then I'll start producing that extra content for all of you who are supporters. So thank you once again. I really appreciate you. So as I mentioned, today I wanted to talk about death's big tent. And by big tent, what I mean is death is really the ultimate big tent. Death includes all of us, everyone, all diversity, all cultures, ethnicities, races, every person on the planet, even every living thing on the planet. So death is the ultimate big tent. And in this dialogue or monologue, I should say, I wanted to discuss how we make room for every point of view in this big tent that death has created for us. And I'll tell you where the idea came from for this topic, because I've really had my own eyes opened recently. First of all, I read an article called "Stop Trying to Soften Bad News for Patients." It was written by Arthur Kaplan, who's the head of medical ethics at NYU School of Medicine. And in this article, he writes about a physician he became aware of who was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer, metastatic. The physician himself, as a doctor, already knew, because of the seriousness and the advanced state of his cancer, that he was terminal, but he was amazed to see that no one would tell him that he was dying. He knew this already, but he was so surprised how everyone around him soft-pedaled the diagnosis itself and really avoided talking to him about prognosis, even though he is a doctor. And he was actually appalled by it and recognized, like, of course, he himself knew he was dying, so he was able to prepare himself and plan ahead for death without anyone around him and the medical profession having that conversation with him. But he realized that the average patient doesn't have that advantage of understanding for themselves the seriousness of their health condition. And the purpose of this article, Arthur Kaplan was telling this doctor's story in order to encourage physicians to start having more honest conversations with their patients, which I am wholeheartedly totally in agreement with. And I've spoken about it a number of times. I often talk about how disappointed I am with my medical colleagues for not doing a better job of having difficult conversations with patients and telling them honestly what their diagnosis is, what their prognosis is, and what they can expect for the future so that patients and their families can begin to prepare and plan ahead for the end of life and for the dying process. So I've been, on the whole, very frustrated with the medical profession. I shared this article on Facebook, on my Facebook page, and was very shocked when I got a response from someone who said, "I totally disagree. I don't want my doctor to try to play God by telling me what my prognosis is." And I was taken aback. I was so surprised that someone would respond that way. And it caused me to stop and think about the fact that there definitely are some people who don't want to have this news delivered to them, who don't necessarily want their doctors to be open and direct with them and honest. And at the very same time, I learned about the movie The Farewell, which is playing in limited theaters around the country right now. Full disclosure, I have not seen the movie myself. It hasn't been in a theater close enough to me for me to get to see it. It's going to require a field trip for me to see the movie, but I did read the synopsis of the movie, so I can tell you what it's about. It's based on a true story, and it's about a Chinese-American family who travels back home to China because the matriarch of the family has been diagnosed with terminal lung cancer and given maybe a few weeks to a few months to live. And the family goes back to see her under the pretense of a family wedding, which has been planned to take place in the town where the matriarch lives, so that the whole family can come there and see her. The reason the wedding is used as a pretense is because this grandmother does not know that she has cancer. She was told by her doctor that the biopsy was benign, even though it was malignant, and no one in the family wants to tell her that she has cancer and that she's terminally ill. That's why this ruse takes place. The wedding is planned, but it's actually an opportunity for all of the relatives to travel to China to see her one last time and say goodbye. So that's the premise of the movie. And the main character, this young Chinese American woman, is returning to China to see her grandmother, but is very upset that no one is telling her the truth. Everyone is complicit in lying to the grandmother, telling her she does not have cancer. The biopsy came back just fine. And she feels strongly that her grandmother should know the truth and should have the correct information, but the rest of the family has made her promise not to tell her grandmother. So that's the premise of the movie, The Farewell, which I'm really looking forward to seeing it and seeing how it plays out. And reading about the movie and hearing the response from the woman who said, "I don't want my doctor to tell me what my prognosis is," caused me to really think about the fact that though I myself believe it's important for people to have factual information, not everyone wants it. Now, the true story of Lulu Wang is the director and creator of the film The Farewell. The true story for her grandmother, who was given this terminal diagnosis 6 years ago, her grandmother is still alive. She still doesn't know that she was ever diagnosed with cancer. She's still here 6 years later. So that's something, that's an interesting twist to think about. But at any rate, it caused me to consider the fact that it's really possibly not appropriate for everyone to hear factual information about their health. It's definitely not desired by everyone. So I did a little research and I came across an interesting article that I wanted to share with all of you out there listening, because many of you I know are in the healthcare industry, perhaps in hospice, perhaps you're a death doula, perhaps you're an educator helping people complete advanced directives in your community or teaching workshops and classes. And I think it's really important for all of us to be sensitive and aware of cultural issues and cultural preferences as we go around teaching people about death and dying. So this article that I found was from the American Family Physician Journal, and it's titled "Cultural Diversity at the End of Life: Issues and Guidelines for Family Physicians." It's by Russell Seawright and Jennifer Gafford of the Forest Park Hospital Family Medicine Residency Program in St. Louis, Missouri. And so this article actually came out way back in February 2005, but it's still very relevant today. And so I wanted to mention some of the points that were brought up in the article and talking a little bit about how we can all be more culturally sensitive and aware in the work that we're doing. And I'm teaching this obviously as something that I needed to spend more time learning myself to really broaden my own horizons a little bit. So I'm not teaching this as an expert. I'm teaching it as a student and sharing with you what I've been learning about as I've been doing my own study. One thing that this article from the journal pointed out that was very eye-opening for me is to remember that those of us of white European descent here in the U.S. tend to be very individualistic as our approach to life. We view the individual as having autonomy and rights, and that's very important to us and something that we cherish and value. And much of our work around end of life information and advanced care planning is based on this belief in the rights of the individual. So including advanced directives, the rights of an individual to state their wishes and preferences for the end of life, to have those wishes honored and carried out by loved ones and by the medical profession. And so this individualistic approach to life informs much of what we do in our society. And when I say we, I'm speaking as those of us of white European descent who make up, perhaps 2/3 of our society, perhaps less now, perhaps closer to 50%. 2/3 is the statistic from back in 2005, but perhaps less now. And it's important for us to realize that people of other cultures and other ethnicities may hold more of a collectivist perspective on life, meaning may view themselves as part of a collective, part of a family, part of a community, part of the whole, and may not share the same desire to have autonomy and to make individual decisions. They may see healthcare decisions and end-of-life decisions as based on what is good for the collective, what is good for everyone in my group, not just what is good for me. So there's this very fundamental difference in point of view that informs all of this end of life work, if we think about it. So as we go through this and talk a little bit about cultural differences, just remember the difference between individualistic and collectivistic in terms of perspective on decision making. So first of all, the article that I'm referencing from the American Family Physician talks about cultural reasons not to disclose accurate information about healthcare diagnoses to the patient. And again, this feels surprising to me because as a doctor, I can't imagine ever lying to a patient, telling a patient that the biopsy was benign when it actually showed cancer. I can't imagine going to that extent and actually telling a lie, though I can imagine using euphemisms or softer words in order to not trigger or frighten a patient. I can't imagine that. But the article mentioned some of the cultural reasons why it may be important not to be so disclosing and so factual in information that's being given. And the first is that for some cultures, discussions of illness and death are considered disrespectful or impolite. And so if a doctor or another healthcare provider brings up the health issue directly face to face with a patient, that may be viewed as a sign of not respecting the patient and the family. A second reason is that for some cultural groups, discussing illness and death may provoke unnecessary depression or anxiety. And for people in these cultural groups, it's believed that it's difficult enough for a patient to be ill, but to talk in such detailed terms about prognosis, about the future, about the possibility of death may add an additional burden for that person to bear, may cause depression, may cause fear that the patient now has to bear in addition to struggling with the illness itself. A third reason why in some cultural groups it's frowned upon to talk about death and dying is the idea that it may eliminate hope. And I believe this is true not just for patients, but one of the reasons that many doctors cite that they're reluctant to talk about death and dying, to give an accurate prognosis to a patient, is that they don't want to take away hope. And they believe powerfully that hope is important for a patient, and they fear that having a very honest, down-to-earth discussion may take away all the hope the patient has left, and perhaps the patient then will give up trying and might die sooner if there is no hope in life or hope in the possibility of living longer. So that particular belief is very common across the board in our society, as I mentioned, including physicians and other healthcare providers. And so the fourth cultural reason not to have conversations about end-of-life issues is that for some cultures, speaking aloud makes something more likely to happen. And so the article mentions that in some Native American cultures, if we talk about death, there's a power in the words to make death happen sooner or more likely to happen. So that could be another reason why it's considered taboo to talk about terminal illness or death for those particular cultures. The second issue to consider around end-of-life issues is who makes decisions for the patient. And again, for many of us in our Western society, we as individuals want to make our own decisions. We hold strongly to that value, that it is the purview of the individual to decide for him or herself what healthcare treatments to receive at the end of life. And making the best decisions requires being given accurate information. So this would be patient-based decision-making. And again, as Westerners, we're more likely to value that type of decision-making. But for some cultures, decision-making is family-based. And I mentioned this before, because there is a collectivist perspective. It's important that an entire family be involved in making important decisions about healthcare, about end-of-life issues. And it's not just the wishes of the patient alone that matter. It's the wishes and the feelings of the entire family. So for those groups, family-based decision-making is valued. For some cultures, physician-based decision-making is valued. There are some cultures for whom physicians are held in high regard and esteem as professionals, and decisions are handed over to the physician, and it's believed that the physician will know the best thing to do, and therefore the patient and family should trust the physician to make the right choice. And I would say even in my own family, my mother, very much at the end of life, even though she was a strong-willed woman who valued her independence and her individualism, at the very end of her life, she really wanted her doctor to be the one to tell her the right thing to do. She didn't feel that she had enough expertise to make a decision herself. So that's physician-based decision-making. And then the fourth type of decision-making is shared family and physician-based decision-making. What I was reading in the article is that family-based decision-making is very common in Asian communities, in Mexican-American communities here in the U.S. Physician-based decision-making is more common for those of Eastern European descent. And shared family and physician-based decision-making is found in Indian and Pakistani communities. Now, this is by no means a comprehensive review of all cultures and all groups and how decisions are made. It was just a few examples that were provided in the article about decision-making. But it's important to remember, if we're trying to approach individuals about creating their advanced directives and making decisions for the end of life, it may be that some of them don't value making their own decision. They value sharing that decision with others or being guided and directed by someone that they feel has more information and more knowledge and authority than they do. So that's important to remember. First of all, remembering the attitudes toward talking about illness and end-of-life issues, and then the locus of decision-making. Who has the power to make decisions and who is trusted to make the decisions? And then the third area to consider is advanced directives and doing advanced care planning, which I already referred to. We know that here in the U.S., there are low rates of completion of advanced directives amongst non-whites. And this is an area of concern for us, but actually the reasons for it may be cultural in origin, and it may be that we're approaching this subject from the wrong perspective if we're not being sensitive and taking into account cultural differences. So some of the reasons the article cited for non-completion and unwillingness to complete advanced directives. First, a distrust of the healthcare system in general. And the whole idea of an advanced directive, it's creating a plan in advance for the end of life that is then somehow turned over as if the power of decision making has already happened. It's incorporated into this paper, and now the medical community will use this piece of paper to make decisions. And the medical community for many people does not appear trustworthy. Some people have had bad experiences in the past or had loved ones who have had difficult experiences with our healthcare system, whether at the end of life or in other experiences when they've needed healthcare. So the lack of trust in our healthcare system underlies, for many people, a reason not to want to complete advanced directives or to be suspicious of the reason why they're being encouraged to complete an advanced directive. And the second issue is healthcare disparities, which also may have led to a distrust of the healthcare system. People who may not have had access to healthcare in the past and may have really been neglected by our healthcare system may see no reason to complete an advanced directive, which to them might look like an excuse for someone else to not provide healthcare to them, particularly a DNR order or an order to withhold CPR may appear to someone who has been discriminated against and not received a proper access to healthcare in the past. It may appear to be just one more attempt to prevent them from getting care that they need. So that's a very powerful reason why someone may be unwilling to complete an advance directive. Another reason why advance directives may be frowned upon for some cultures is the actual perspective on death itself and suffering. For some cultures, aggressive end-of-life care is seen as a sign of love and devotion. Doing everything possible to keep a loved one alive may be a sign of respect for that person, a sign of caring. And while many of us recoil at that idea because we feel it's far more caring to allow natural death and to not prolong suffering or through artificial means, it makes sense that for some cultures, using all means available and every tool that we have to help someone live as long as possible could be seen as a sign of love and a sign of caring. And it's important to recognize that and not judge that attitude, but to receive it as an attempt to be positive, an attempt to be caring, an attempt to do what's best, and not sit in judgment of people who might hold that belief system. Fourth is a spiritual perspective around advance directives. And I think this it relates to the person who responded to that first article that I shared about encouraging physicians not to soften the information that they give to patients. That person felt that, well, wouldn't the doctor then be playing God? If the doctor says to me, you have 6 months to live, isn't that the doctor trying to be God and trying to place a sentence on my life when only God can decide how much longer I have to live? So that spiritual perspective says that planning ahead for death is in some way not showing faith that there is a God who will have authority over the dying process and who will be the ultimate decider of how the dying process unfolds. So to create an advance directive may seem like an attempt to take things out of God's hands. Even to say, I don't want to be resuscitated, may to some people feel like disrespectful of the God that they believe in, who is in charge and who should be directing the dying process. And a fifth reason why some people may be reluctant to sign advance directives is simply the family dynamics, a feeling that it should be up to the family to make decisions in the moment as things are unfolding at the end of life, and that to create a plan in advance that eliminates this family decision making would do harm to the family. So these are all concerns to consider if you're talking to someone who seems reluctant to complete an advance directive. To remember, there may be distrust of the healthcare system. The person may have been neglected by healthcare in the past, may have a cultural perspective that aggressive care is the best way to show love, may resist the idea of playing God by trying to plan ahead for death, and may have a belief that the family should make a decision when the time comes and an individual should not make the decision in advance. So as we looked at these three areas, having conversations about accurate diagnosis and prognosis with patients, about who makes decisions for the patient's healthcare, and then attitudes toward advance directives and advance care planning, I wanted to share some thoughts about how to approach people who may have a different cultural perspective about death and dying and end-of-life issues than I have, and how perhaps to still engage in a conversation and create a positive interaction about end-of-life issues. So first of all, I think it's essential that we remember that all perspectives are contained under the big tent. everyone who's here is part of the experience of death and dying and will experience it. And every belief system is valid and should be honored. So I think, first of all, we ourselves need to become open to all perspectives. And while we may know what is right for us, we may have beliefs for ourselves of exactly how we want to be treated and what outcome we would like to see at our end of life. And we also know what we think might be best for other people. We also hold our own opinions about that. But I think it's very important to stay open to other perspectives and to let go of our need to have the answers for others and to be willing to consider that maybe what we think is best isn't right for everyone. And be willing to let go of our preconceived ideas and simply be open to whatever new information might be available to us. And next, I think we need to do our best to be aware of any potential cultural, religious, or societal differences with people that we're working with. So I think we need to, no matter who we're working with, and no matter what their racial, religious, ethnic, cultural, social identity is, I think we need to ask questions to find out, what are your beliefs around death and dying? What has your family experienced? What do you hold as important around death and dying? So I think we need to be willing to ask a lot of questions in the beginning to allow ourselves to become informed so that we can spot when there are potential conflicts between what we would like to teach someone or where we would like to guide someone to go and what their belief system holds as the best possible course for them. So be open to all perspectives. Make yourself aware of when differences exist by asking questions. I think it's also a good idea to consider alternatives. Now, you know, we might be used to sitting down with people and talking about advanced directives in a certain way, talking with individuals about their own advanced directives and how to complete them, how to make decisions, how to put down in writing what kind of care they want at the end of life. But if we become aware that there are some cultural obstacles and cultural differences to having that discussion, perhaps we could approach it in a different way. Perhaps we have conversations with families. And maybe even if you're a teacher out there teaching workshops about advanced directives, perhaps you offer a family workshop around end-of-life care. And you invite families to come, because what you might find is that a group of family members may be interested in getting information. They may not even want the patient to be part of it or bring the patient into that conversation, but there may be family members who are looking for information. And then I think that you could have conversations with family members about the potential needs for care for their loved one. Where do they see their loved one being when their loved one needs more intense care? At home? Do they have the means of caring for a loved one at home? Do they perceive their loved one being in a facility? Do they know what their loved one might prefer? And have they talked about it as a family? You could also ask questions about what have other family members experienced at the end of life? What commonly happens when an elder member of the family is dying, and how have they handled that situation in the past? That can give you a great deal of information. And also ask them, would they like to know about other alternatives or other options? What might serve them that you could share with them? So you may not even get around to talking about having an advanced directive form, but at least you can encourage family members to have some of these conversations in advance and to do their best to try to find out what their loved one might prefer. They may not be ready to put it down in writing in the form of an advanced directive, and they may not be ready to bring their loved one in to have the conversation face to face, but you could talk to them about what they have inferred perhaps from their grandmother and what, as I said before, what other family members have experienced at the end of life in the past, how it worked out, what changes they might like to see happen. I think another important question to ask if you are talking with a family or if you are talking with an individual is perhaps, what does a good death look like? You may not be able to use the words good death. Death itself might be a word that is still seems taboo to that particular family or person. But you could ask about, has anyone had a good ending to their lives in their family, and what was that like? And what do they believe is important when someone is at the end of life? So that you could try to ascertain the ideals and the values of that person or the family and their culture, and what it means at the end of life to have a positive ending. And I think that could be a good opening for a conversation, and then talk about, how can we support you? How can we support you as a family and your loved one to have this good and positive ending that you desire? Now, I know that in the death positive movement, a lot of people talk about making sure that you use death, dying, use those words directly, not use euphemisms. But I do think in these instances, when we're trying to have sensitive conversations with people, I think we need to ascertain whether or not it's culturally appropriate for the person we're talking to use those words. And is it preferable to use a euphemism? Is it more comfortable? Is it less triggering if we do use a euphemism? So I think you have to be open to everything and be open to the fact that you may not be able to talk in the same terms that you might talk to someone else about death and dying, and be willing to be flexible with the terminology that you use. And then I think another helpful question to ask is, what does hope mean to you? Because we talked about that being a factor that's actually widespread across our entire society, of that people don't want to hear the truth and the facts about a terminal illness because of a fear of losing hope. And doctors don't want to communicate that directly also, out of fear that they'll take hope away from the patient. So I think it's a great question to ask, what does hope mean to you? Where does hope come from? Where does your hope come from? And so think about it this way. For some people, hope comes from their faith, their belief system, their religion, a belief in God. They base their hope outside of themselves, but in something greater than them that they hold a powerful belief in. And so the source of hope comes from a higher power. And so I think it's possible to talk about illness, about diagnosis, about end-of-life issues, without questioning the higher power, by acknowledging if your hope comes from your belief system, your beliefs are intact and will remain and will still support you and still provide you with hope, regardless of the outcome of the testing that we're doing. Whether the biopsy shows that you have a malignancy or is benign, your hope, which resides in something greater than yourself, will still be there no matter what. And so I think it depends on, how do we talk about things? If we honor the belief system of the person we're working with, we can keep their hope intact. So for some, hope might come from their family. It might come from the support and love that they feel from those people around them. Again, we can talk honestly about illness and diagnosis and end-of-life issues without taking away the family. They will still have all the love and support of the family. It will be there for them just the same. So all of the hope that comes from being part of a loving community and a network remains intact regardless of the diagnosis and regardless of the prognosis. So hope that comes from that source, from the connectedness of being in a community or family, it's not diminished by finding out a terminal diagnosis. A third possibility for some people is that their hope actually resides in technology and medicine. Some people who live a very rational existence and embrace science may place all of their hope in medical treatments. In this case, it's probably essential that these people actually have accurate information about their diagnosis, because they are going to make treatment decisions, if that's the locus of their hope is on technology and medicine, they need to know what they're dealing with in order to make the best possible decisions. Now, for myself, I feel like placing hope in medicine is a little bit shaky, because medicine doesn't always have answers for everything that's happening. But we should be aware that there are some people who believe very strongly in the latest advances, the latest research, new experimental drugs. And for some people, that's where hope comes from. Those people may not be willing to give up getting treatments. Those people may not want to say, I will stop all treatment and enter hospice, because if their only hope is in the technology and in receiving medical treatments, they really will be leaving aside hope if that's the only source of hope in their lives. So consider that for some people, the only way they can stay hopeful and optimistic and positive about the experience they're having is to continue to receive treatments. Some people actually receive hope from the doctor that is providing treatment for them. Some people have a relationship almost of reverence with their medical doctor, and they may believe that a particular doctor has healing abilities or healing powers or can work miracles, and that person may place all of their hope in being a patient and being cared for by a particular doctor or a particular clinic. And so if a patient places hope in a person, then it's important that that relationship not be severed too rapidly. It's important that that person be allowed to continue the relationship so that their hope stays intact. Again, of course, I see that as a rather shaky source of hope, given that doctors are fallible too, and there's no doctor that has all the answers. And, you know, no doctor can actually prevent death when it's time for death to come. But if you find out that a patient you're caring for or talking with believes fully in the doctor that's treating them, then it may be important to make sure that person can continue to have contact with the doctor and to feel that that person still has the blessing of their doctor, no matter what choices are made, so that they continue to hold on to that source of hope. And then finally, some people simply have hope within themselves. They find hope within their own heart. They somehow believe, I'm strong. I've been through challenges before. I believe that I can handle whatever comes my way. I trust myself. I'll make the right decisions. And they have an internal locus of hope for themselves. And so, again, when a person has that inner sense of hopefulness, it's something the person can't necessarily lose, but hope may have to be redefined a little bit. Maybe the hope of overcoming an illness becomes the hope of living as well as possible for all the days of my life until it's time for me to die. So maybe hope needs to be redefined. Instead of believing that I can fight any illness that comes my way, instead believing that I can live well despite any illness that comes my way. I can make the most of my life no matter what happens to my health, no matter if I do have an illness that cannot be cured, I can still live my best life for all the days that I have left. So a person whose belief system is internal and believing in themselves and their own strength might need help expanding that belief system a little bit to see that hope can be based not just in surviving and overcoming and fighting the disease, but hope in how I can live and be my best and highest self no matter what else is happening in my life. So I think asking about hope is something that you can do with any person that you're working with, finding out what hope means to that person, and then where is their source of hope? From where do they derive hope for their own lives? What gives them hope in life? And I think with each one of these responses, whether it's hope from faith and God, hope from family and connectedness, hope in technology and medicine, hope in the person of a doctor or healer, and hope within myself, I think that you can begin with the belief system of each person. When you find out their locus of hope, regardless of culture, regardless of other beliefs, when you discover where does their hope come from, I think that you can learn a lot about how to talk with that person and how to work with them as you look toward more honest discussions about end-of-life issues. Begin with hope and make your priority preserving hope as much as possible for that person, and reassure them that you have no desire to take hope away from them. Your desire only is to augment their hope and help them find even a broader source of hope in their lives than they may have experienced before. And I think that discussion can work for people from any culture with any belief system. I think the discussion around hope is a good place to begin. So I'm not suggesting that you become an authority on other cultures necessarily and know all about all cultures and what people believe and how they like to be talked about around the end of life. I do think it's important to look at these aspects. Can you remain open-minded and open-hearted about all other cultures? Can you let go of whatever you know to be the best and wisest course for people at the end of life and allow that what works for many of us may not work for all of us? Make the tent of death that you work under so large that there's room for everyone. There's room for people who choose to continue aggressive treatments at the end of life. There's room for people who want everything possible done for themselves or for a loved one at the end of life. There's room for all choices under this big tent of death. So remember that we need to honor everyone and respect the choices and the values of everyone, and recognize that each person and each family and each community group has the right to choose what feels most comfortable for them, and be there to offer support and to offer love, to offer hope in any way that you can within the boundaries of their belief system. That's when I think will be the most helpful and make the most difference for people. Help them find hope wherever they're coming from and whatever their belief system is. So I covered a lot of topics there within that discussion. And as I said, I drew heavily from the article on cultural diversity at the end of life that I mentioned. I'm going to link to that in the show notes for this episode, which you will find at eolupodcast.com. And you can look for episode number 215. So I'll have a link to that article, also to the article encouraging physicians to not soften the news when they talk to patients. So you can check out that article as well. Thanks for listening to my rambling discussion here. A couple of announcements before I go. Remember, the Beautiful Dying Expo is coming up November 2nd in San Diego. Find out more at beautifuldyingexpo.com. If you're in the area or you can get to San Diego, I hope you'll join me there. I'll be attending. So Saturday, November 2nd in San Diego. BeautifulDyingExpo.com. There's also Before I Die Arizona taking place October 29th through November 3rd in Scottsdale, Arizona. You can find out about that event at BeforeIDieAZ.com. And that's a little bit longer conference. Also, both of these are going to be amazing events. So check out the website so you can find out who will be there, who's presenting, and what the topics are. And remember, networking with like-minded people is just a great way to continue to grow and learn, and also to stay excited and to stay passionate about the work that we're all doing. We all need to get refreshed and rejuvenated from time to time, and networking and going to conferences is a great way to do that. So I hope you'll take a look around and see what events are out there that you might attend for inspiration and education. And also remember, this podcast airs a new episode every Monday. So tune in 1 week for the next episode. And until then, remember that we're here for love. So face your fear, be ready for whatever life brings your way, and love each and every moment of your life. Bye-bye.